Welcome to Solo TV Dinner with Tim and Tay, a podcast that looks at one critical episode in the arc of a TV series every other week. We explore how the episode is constructed, what the episode achieves, and what it can tell us about the series as a whole. I'm Tim.
And I'm Tay. Welcome to TV with Tim and Tay. We are now done with film, done with movies as a medium, and are moving exclusively to television as a format worthy of discussion. Your thoughts, Tim?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're just giving people what they wanted, right? And I think we're seeing the writing on the wall. You know, theaters, there's no real good reason to attend a theater, I don't think. Like, I mean, a lot of the best movies out there, they come out at home the same time. And I just don't think, like, there's anyone making movies that are, like, they need to be experienced in, like, I don't know, for example, like extra large format or with like multiple channels of audio or really anything that like you're kind of like, you know, too dim TV at home can provide, right? It's all the same.
I don't know about you, Tim, but I really need a break every 35 minutes. So watching something that's 3 hours long is totally unfeasible. And I'm glad we're starting to like pick up on the vibe out there and we're switching our focus to something much more relevant and topical.
I agree. Like, I'd rather watch something that's like fundamentally 10 hours long instead of like 90 minutes long.
Oh, that's the best.
Because I mean, they get to do more. And also it means like, I don't always have to pay attention because like there's more of it. So like, if I want to look at my phone or something and I miss like 10 minutes of dialogue, it's probably okay. Because at the start of the next episode, they're going to remind me what happened in the episode before that I just watched. It feels like it's more catered to like my level of attention and my degree of investment in the stories that are being told, you know?
Absolutely. It's very demanding to ask me to sit for that long, and I just don't feel that it's fair. So TV, clearly the format of the future, it's where the most rewarding, yeah, most compelling stories go to live, and I think it's only going to keep getting better from here. So from now on, to all of our patrons out there, thanks for listening, but we are no longer a movie podcast.
Yeah, we're going to talk what you want to hear about, which is TV shows. And we wanted to make it easy, this sort of transition, because we know it'll ruffle a few feathers from those darn cinephiles, those snooty art house movie lovers.
Yeah, tell you out there, get on
so
our
we
train.
We thought like maybe... Right? Maybe we grease the tracks a little bit here, and we're going from our Star Wars movies, the end of our movie era, and we'll use a Star Wars TV show to get us into this new era of the show. And I mean, I know people out there probably would love for us to look into something like Obi-Wan or the Book of Boba Fett, but maybe we'll throw those into a vote. That we know they're all just phenomenal shows, but we're going to dig in first with Andor, because it's really in that pocket of we did Star Wars 1977 and then we did Rogue One, which introduced the character. So we felt it was fitting.
Yeah, I think it's about time that we discuss a TV show, and I'm really happy we can start with Andor. It took some convincing, I got to say, Tim, that took a while for me to come around to watch this. There were so many components of this that struck me as interesting, whether it was hearing about certain casting decisions or the choice to have Tony Gilroy come in and direct. There's a lot of things that stood out to me as like, okay, why does this sound so different? And why do people actually recommend this TV show to me, person who doesn't watch TV very much, or pretty much never? Yeah. And when you started telling me more about it, I was like, okay, I probably will like that. And it was like a matter of time commitment thing. But having to watch it for this, like throughout this month for this episode, it was a great experience. I really enjoyed the TV show. I think it's blown away every other Star Wars thing that Disney's ever done, in my opinion. Not even really much of a discussion there for me. But the fact that this was such a mature IP film is like, or such a mature IP TV series is really telling about where we're at with this Star Wars universe, and like it kind of paints a confusing picture about the future, to be honest.
Yeah, no, it's a really singular thing, and you know, I was definitely on the other side of those conversations a number of times trying to tell you I think you would like Andor, things like that, and that's especially like even before our 1977 Star Wars episode. I wasn't 100% clear on like how far back your history goes with Star Wars and how much of a fan you are. And I think it really walks a real graceful tightrope in being a very an uncompromising story told within what is usually a very compromised IP, right? Something that has to serve a lot of different masters and has to do a lot of things. And I think it manages to develop really powerful characters, very memorable characters, and tell very powerful stories while still like towing that PG-13 line, while still feeling like it's in Star Wars, but while also not committing what I would consider the cardinal sin of all that Disney Star Wars, which is like, you might get something original for a little while, but then they start getting celebrity cameos from like Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader, and they can't really, they don't trust it to go on without them bringing in someone that you remember from your childhood, that you remember from a movie. And I mean, we are going to structure this episode in terms of non-spoilers going into spoilers. And I think there's arguably one celebrity Star Wars cameo in the series. But it's very, it's a post-credit sequence and it's very well hidden. And it's very slight. So we can get to that later. Cause I guess technically it's a spoiler.
Well, there are a couple characters sprinkled in here that are drawn from some of the original Star Wars films, actually, which I thought was really great, because it really showed that by not focusing on the nostalgia aspect of bringing characters back, you can still have these characters from your IP in your product, but you don't have to have the nostalgia factor. Having Mon Mothma, I keep saying Mon Mothma every time I say her name.
That's a cool crossover.
I know, right? But Mon Mothma,
I would like to see like a big moth monster, like, you know, trying to trash the system because they can't access their family funds.
Right.
You know? Maybe just like trashing the Senate.
Yeah, exactly.
Filibustering.
Have a big moth in there.
Yeah. Anyway.
But having her as a central character really stood out to me about the series, just because I was like, okay, so I recognize this face. I know who this character is. I've watched Star Wars my whole life, but I never knew anything about the backstory, nor did I, but I also didn't feel like this was something that was just kind of jammed in. It felt like a lot of thought was put into like the arc of this character, and knowing how, or like the role she ends up in as part of the rebellion leadership. It's really cool to see the early stages and kind of be curious about the in between now. I've found with other Star Wars crossover shows and movies, which I've tried to get into, most of them, it's all nostalgia. It is literally like, okay, remember all these characters who you literally don't care about? We're going to tell you more about them and try and cram them in just so you have familiarity and you're not like, who are all these new people? Having Mon Mothma as like really the only recognizable character from the original Star Wars is a really cool thing that you need to, I felt like they really focused on strong female leads in the show too. And she really is a glorious example of how to do nostalgia right.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the Mon Mothma story. It's obviously like Tony Gilroy's interested in like all these different levels of rebellion. How does a rebellion actually happen? Can we go beyond like the idea of, you know, Luke joins up the rebellion after his aunt and uncle are killed, and within, I don't know, a week or so, he's blown up the Death Star. And it's like, no, there's like, you know, we can look at this in a more interesting and nuanced way without, again, I think like alienating too many people. Because there's certainly like a only conversation version of this show, a much drier one that I think would be more alienating to viewers who are expecting a certain degree of action or something. But almost every one of the little arcs in this show has some sort of climax that has a form of action in it,
right?
Whether it's an escape or a heist or a prison break, or again, like a riot forming during a funeral.
Yeah. I really like the layout of the show in general in that regard, but, yeah, maybe let's cover our paperwork as always.
Yeah. as always. So just in case you haven't watched it, maybe you haven't. We don't really know our audience that well in terms of TV shows at this point. but Andor tells the story of the titular hero's journey from apathetic rogue to dyed-in-the-wool rebel, acting as a prequel to Rogue One, starring Diego Luna and created by Tony Gilroy. Andor premiered September 21st, 2022. They are in the process of working on a second season. I think it's now at this point. It got pushed back by the writers and actors strikes necessarily. So I think they're looking at next year.
Yeah, it's in the can though. They finished shooting in February.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to that. And actually maybe at the very end, we can do, you know, under 5 minutes on what we think that looks like, which I think would be interesting. But I mean, other than that, budget and box office don't totally apply to TV shows. Neither do taglines. So I think we can just dig into the TV show.
Right.
Yeah, so I mean, maybe as a way to get into this is I'm sure, like with you, you mentioned the Rogue One episode that you had heard. You know, they mentioned that they're going to do a Rogue One movie and a Boba Fett movie, and they're looking at things. And I remember at some point in that, it came out after Rogue One that they were going to do a show on Cassian Andor. And I think, like a lot of people, I was like, who cares? Like, what? Like, honestly, what do I need to know about this guy who's like a secondary character in Rogue One? And it's really, it's sort of the creative intention that makes this show what it is. And that's nothing against Diego Luna, who I think is phenomenal. But his character is a concept coming out of Rogue One I wasn't entirely hooked on.
Did you ever see that? I don't remember what episode of Red Letter Media's Half in the Bag it was, but they had like the little action figure of Cassian Andor, and they kept cutting back to him and being like, who is this character?
Like, who do you know his guy? Name? I can hear like Mike's voice or whoever the one guy is. Who is he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's all I kept thinking about when they announced this show.
Yeah. It really just like on as a concept, it kind of like we were saying with like the stuff that they pulled out off partially with Rogue One and more so in our overview of Andor. As a concept, it's a pretty daring thing to, I think, try to push within the Disney machine, is to say, listen, this guy has almost no brand recognition. His name will not get people to click their remotes towards it on your streaming platform. But we have a pretty celebrated writer in Tony Gilroy. And we're going to get a pretty strong cast of other writers too. Bo Willimon is a primary writer on one of these arcs in the episode we're going to talk about today, who's known primarily for House of Cards, but has done other
that
sort of modern
a lot
prestige
of that dialogue,
stuff.
Actually.
Yeah, very sort of like monologue-y, like it's dialogue first stuff, which I am 100% ready to admit that won't work for everybody, but it works for me. I can engage with a little bit more actorly, a little bit more theatrical.
Yeah.
Especially when well deployed in balance. But
and PG. Remember it's PG-13, right?
Yep.
So that was something I kept in mind the whole way through and was super impressed by the handling of. Because when you get slapped with a PG-13 rating, I have a lot of concerns about conveying realism in a dramatic and violent story like this. But I thought that I'm going to point a few things out throughout our talk today, but I thought that was really well done throughout the show. And I do think it's quickly worth noting Tony Gilroy's involvement in the development of this product too, because he was brought in to basically help finish and correct the mess that was Rogue One, the film, and took a huge and was very passionate and took an interest in the character of Andor, probably after talking with Diego Luna, I'm sure, because Luna came on to produce this as well. And what he did, they had the plans for this show, which was supposed to be more about Andor and K2SO, his robot companion from the movie. But when Gilroy found that out, he actually penned a letter to Kathleen Kennedy himself. And within a year, he had replaced the other showrunner because they just felt that Tony Gilroy's idea was so much stronger than... And he I think he just literally, from what I read, he argued that this story actually has so much more value than what you're giving it. And I think that they took a huge swing at giving him this very politically charged, very mature, maturely written and maturely handled narrative. And it really worked well for me. I love the idea that this is not a Star Wars first movie. It is simply a human story. A very complex one at that, that takes place mm-hmm. within this very well-known universe full of very familiar iconographies and visuals and aesthetics, but that's not first and foremost like the other Star Wars nostalgia products.
Of course, yeah, no, and I think it's a real credit to Star Wars by saying that Star Wars has always been about like good versus evil, right? Whether yeah. it's Lucas being inspired by like the wars that he was a witness to in his home country, the United States, and what they were doing in Korea and Vietnam and things like that. And also the generation above him still obviously very much influencing the idea of like we defeated the Nazis, all that stuff at play, to instead of, you know, maintaining that depth into like what could have been like probably a war spy show is what I heard originally about Cassian Andor, like him, like, you know, sneaking into the Empire and out and things like that, which
sure.
could have certainly been slick and interesting. But to dig deeper into the idea that, okay, if it's about good versus evil, where do those things start to flip a little bit? Where, and like, especially what it, I think like, Gilroy's core interest in this appears to me, this isn't from interviews, but I think what this show seems to be obsessed with is like, what is the actual cost of rebellion? Like, is there an yes. obligation to rebel, and what is the cost of it? And, you know, people argue that this is like, you know, maybe your solo instance of true anti-fascist art in the modern age, right? And it happens in the Star Wars universe, which is a really incredible thing. And to show, as we mentioned, at Cassian's level on both, so the I don't know at what point we want to call things spoilers. It did come out in 2022, but I want to talk generally about sort of the different levels of civilization that are on display and how they're affected by the Empire. We're going to jump around through some of the episodes. I'm not sure.
I think we can jump into spoilers about now. Like we're at the point. Like,
yeah.
Like, Tim and I both like the show. If that was what you cared about hearing, then great. Go yeah. watch it. But
go check it out if you haven't. Yeah.
Yeah, please do check it out. But if you are familiar with the show, here's where we will begin our spoilers unabashedly.
Yeah, we'll put up that Rogue One siren again. That's the spoiler warning siren. Yeah. Yeah, so I wanted to mention, like, if you go all the way back, like, in their flashbacks in the first arc, you've got Cassian growing up on Canary, which just has, like, again, I don't think an over-explained representation of, like, the Empire's effect on a planet and that effect on an indigenous local people.
No, it gives you just enough to extrapolate information.
Yeah, that they're, like, fracking to the core of this planet, and also whether it's a cultural thing for Cassian's people or if they were trying to be told something, and I think it's the latter, is that there are no adults in their tribe, right? That they've all been wiped out. They've gone to war. Who knows? It's all children. And then there's a strata of older children and younger children. So a lot of like show don't tell to essentially just basically tell you that like, the beginning of Cassian's character as we know it was sort of instigated by Imperial action. And that's yes. how he met Marva. And I can't remember his adopted dad's
Clem.
Name. Clem. Of course, the name he gives himself in the second arc. And how he meets them and starts to learn the skills that I think you associate him with in the first chunk of the show, which is, you know, scavenger, looking first for himself, just trying to get by, right?
Yeah, and I love that we get a vignette of this planet, these people, this collective that we don't know anything about from other Star Wars IPs. And it really reflected like, I think it really showed me that the showrunners knew what they were doing, because they're introducing a new planet that has not been talked about or not been mentioned even in any of the other Star Wars shows. And they've created a culture, like a very, living, breathing culture that I can like, kind of extrapolate information from here. And it also gives our central character like a really good starting point without really telling us too like it allows this information to like stew too for later seasons, which is something I might not appreciate about a lot of TV, but I think in the hands of a trusted writer like this, I know that anything that they might want to tie back to Canary later is probably going to be like well thought out. I also like how we get tidbits about Kanari, the planet, and the people from random interactions when people are talking about the Kanari refugee, when he's like a wanted man. We get little fractions of information where they'll say like, oh, like there's no Kanari people left or things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's all, I think it's all sprinkled very well. And whether that becomes something in season two, like again, his opening impetus when we meet him is he's looking for his sister from Kanari.
Mm-hmm.
And very quickly his priorities have to change because of how just coincidentally he falls into an absolute nightmare of a situation.
Which Tony Gilroy described as very film noir, which I totally agree with.
I think so. He accidentally kill like a security guard, not even a cop, right? I love that it's secondary, third party hired out security by the Empire, which is just like, when you start to look at it, you're like, how realistically they're sort of representing, like, if a single body was trying to control an entire galaxy, like, there'd be all these gaps, it'd be so sloppy, and there'd be these weird third party guys who are just like, they also don't want to be there. They're also hanging out there drunk and they're going to these strip clubs that they shouldn't be at. And
for the record, these are Primor security is what they're called.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who also, I mean, I actually, let's circle back. Let's put a pin in Cyril Karn because I think we want to talk about him.
Please.
But I wanted to just sort of continue. Like, you've got the Kanari sort of beginning and the Empire's effect on that. Then you have Rix Road and Ferrix, where it's just sort of like an occupied factory city. And I love just the little tiny bits where like everyone's just a little on edge, right? Like they're all trying to work within these very strict rules. But then every time something happens, the rules get notched up. And I love later in the season when you see like they're talking from the Empire side where it's like, well, they applied for a permit for a funeral. But of course, we're not going to give it to them. Or like when we do give it to them, we only allow them to have 30 people. You know, just these little ongoing instances of oppression, just these small things, right? Curfews, and just like small instances of violence, like stuff that happens to people that Cassian knows there on Ferrix that happens so quickly.
So right? We already kind of mentioned it about Kanari, but also about Ferrix and Eldani. They often had people from the Empire kind of have like a cultural specialist explain the cultural traditions to someone of like higher authority. In these, they really crafted these sequences well because they didn't feel too heavy-handed. And like you're kind of mentioning this one moment where it's like, oh, like they had to apply for permission, and we learned so much about how the system works just from that interaction, which seems very natural anyway. So I really liked how I got to learn about several different Star Wars planetary cultures without taking away or adding too much like nonsense to this already like very complex universe.
The Eldani one is particularly compelling, where they explain like it's this celestial event once every 7 years. There used to be thousands of Eldanis would come on this pilgrimage, and now like they've displaced them into like reservations. They've wiped a lot of them out who fought back, and then the ones that still make the pilgrimage, there's the really, really insidious part where the guy's like, well, we place these pleasure houses along the route with cheap drinks, and it whittles down their numbers. And
which
it's
is
just
so
horrifying. It's the slimiest stuff, right?
Yeah, that actually was one of the big takeaways, that like specific bit about the fascist regime, where I was like, that is actually really intense, and they're really suggesting some true sense of evil from the Empire with little statements like that. And that's what really pushes this above and beyond like a normal Star Wars concept, right? It's like talking about the cruelty of these human beings. Just before I like forget this point entirely, I did want to say that there's not a lot of aliens or other species in the show as a whole.
Like,
it's almost
entirely
human.
There's not a lot of
makeup,
you know? Yeah.
So a lot of what we're talking about are very human concepts. And I thought that maybe adding aliens throughout would have been maybe better visually or maybe more tied to Star Wars. But I really liked how it felt like a very human drama, and I think a lot of it comes back to this idea that it's mostly humans, and the traditions of these three planets we're talking about are all tied to very human things. So I felt that that's what also added a strong connective tissue to our real life.
Yeah,
to real life. So
it's even like the, we'll talk about this in our episode, but even the Shyandralin culture is pretty well fleshed out in little drops and stuff, even though that's less about like the empire's encroaching presence on their culture, and it's more turned on its head for a different reason. But still, I think you get so much depth of different peoples in this, other than, like, again, I wish there were more aliens in this too, whether they were CGI or makeup. But as compared to just like, you know, you go to the cantina, the Mos Eisley cantina, and you're like, look at how big this universe is. Look at how many different types of people there are. And you know nothing about them. Nothing against that. But this is just sort of like, it's almost a flip side of the same coin. It's
right.
They don't have as much money maybe to spend on makeup, or maybe they were unsure they could get a real sympathetic connection with the audience with someone covered with makeup and looking different or non-humanoid.
I did really like the two big aliens that help Cassian escape from the prison. One of them's named Freely. I can't remember the other one. Yeah. But they were
hilarious. And their language is almost like a patois. Like, it's like some of their words are English-esque words. And yeah, those guys were like Douglas Adams aliens. They reminded me of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Very much so. Even with like the goofy net contraptions they had. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then
they would have been my
shout-out,
but I did want to talk about like the lack of humans, and I wanted to mention them as like the counterexample to that. So I wanted to mention that tied to the like this whole concept of planetary traditions and cultures too.
Yeah,
made it much more relatable.
Completely unshown, but also they mention an alien species that they use for the basis for their torture device, where they're like, we were wiping out an alien species, and we realized that when people were reviewing the archival footage of the mission, they all started to lose their minds. So we took that recording of the young ones of the aliens pleading for their lives, and then, you know, remixed them and turned them into like a super effective torture device that like just like flips multiple Ferrix residents and Anto Krieger's pilot basically in an instant, right?
Yeah, and that's going to tie into what I want to discuss in greater detail with the idea of it being a PG-13 that is still really compelling on a visceral level like that, because it's a torture device. We're told about it, and we never hear what the sound is actually going to be, which is very powerful in concept when you're making anything for the screen. If you can convince your audience that something is so horrifying that you wouldn't want to hear it, and you show a character experiencing it, it's very powerful that the audience is creating that sound for themselves. And this is really strong PG-13, like, script writing right here. We have the character Bix, and we experience it personally through her journey, but we also see it through her eyes. She sees the effect on someone else, the guy who's being tortured in there before her. And then we see her fear, and then we see her and we see her strength and resilience, but then we see her crumble instantly to this torture mechanism. Yeah. Really effective, just visual information that doesn't have to get violent or disturbing or really anything like that.
I think it's disturbing enough.
Yes.
You know, it's the kind of thing where like, if I was like 9 and I was watching this, that thing would kind of like, I'd be like, whoa, that really sticks with you. Right?
But I guess I mean like there's no blood, or they're not like torturing like physically, or you know what I mean? Like not and like then, to the body.
Yeah, and I'm sure that Tony Gilroy loves the thematic idea that, like, the torture is being exposed to the results of the Empire's violence, right? Like,
it all comes, that it, can it take all goes it, full circle.
Take it too far, like, probably in small doses, as you see in the course of this show, that can be what, like, sparks the fire and gets someone to join the rebellion. But if it's too much, if you were to take on the weight of the suffering that the Empire has brought on the galaxy, it would break your brain, right? You'd lose your soul.
And we still don't know really the result of what's going to happen to Bix. By the end of the episode, she's pretty much brain dead.
Yeah.
Or at least seemingly. So I think that they'll probably have some form of recovery for her in season two, but I can't imagine. If they return her to full status, I will kind of be a little skeptical of this from season one. I think it's really meaningful what they've done here.
Yeah. I think that if they want her to be something like she was, they really have to earn it. Whereas if she becomes something else, if there's a progression to this and she finds a new role is found, or she becomes a liability, I don't see Tony Gilroy pulling any punches, right? Like,
I don't think so either. I mean, that's one of the big things we want to discuss in general is just we see very much in depth the cost in both the Rebellion and the Empire side of things. We get to see the very human stories that are very nuanced and very human. And then we get to kind of extrapolate all these different stories and kind of paint this picture of why being in the Empire could be a very conflicting position to be in as a human. And being in the Rebellion is not only dangerous, but it's almost like there's almost non-existent trust in that world, which creates all these other problems.
That it's not fun.
Yes.
Right? Like, we extolled 1977 Star Wars for its simplicity and its great effect. And I'll never deny that, but this is the other side of that I think Gilroy's getting into. It's like, you don't just leave the farm and go blow up the Death Star. Like, there are countless people like Andor and like Luthen and Saw Gerrera and, you know, all these people who are floating, like Lonnie in the episode we're going to talk about.
Right.
These people who are, you know, developing heart disease and stress disorders because of what they're doing, let alone like being found out and being tortured and being killed and having their families wiped out. You know, it's, I think there's a real gravity to this. And I think the cost of Rebellion, a lot of that's reflected in the episode we're going to talk about today. So before we move there, I think just one thing that's not in the episode that I know we want to talk about is Cyril Karn.
Right. Very strong character. I was very compelled from really early in the series how they were what they were going to do with this guy. I thought, I don't have the actor's name in front of me, but it's a good performance. He's got a fantastic look. He's got huge pupils and they're
big,
like
big kind of watery eyes and
pupils, and he has this great look where he almost looks like he's always on rolling on high emotion. Everything is intense. And then we get to see like the layers peeled back of this character when he is basically fired. He's told that the Primor security sector has been taken over by the Empire and his services are no longer required, even though he is about as headstrong as it gets in terms of fulfilling the Empire's mandate, but can't even operate within the Empire's system to actually accomplish that because he's been pushed down and they even lied about his whole report and tried to suppress him. So it really tells this human side of it. And then we get to see his actual home life, which I don't know if you want to touch on.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say, the actor's name is Kyle Soller, and I think he does a great job in this because you're right. He's always so pitched. He's, like, always on the verge of, like, having to explain that, like, he's the rare true believer in the occupying power.
Yeah.
He's one of the few where he's like, they are not doing enough. How do people not get this, right? But Kyle Soller, like, he's a very handsome guy, as you mentioned. He's got very, very, like, striking blue eyes stuff. But I also think he's cast very well as, like, he's a little boyish and almost like, almost like you're just kind of like a mother would be like, my son is so handsome, and he is handsome, but like, it's not a hero handsome. Like, it's very, the casting is very good on this.
I'd say like he's very squirrely and, almost, and very boyish.
And I just like the writing, just like how they give you little data points about his character, where like his supervisor in one of his first scenes is like, did you alter your uniform? And he's like, just a little tailoring and piping. Like, he's vain. And then like when he's leading a squad, which he shouldn't be, he can't make a speech that's any good. But his second in command, that great Scottish guy, everything that guy says rules. Like, it just rolls off the tongue. Like, I love you find these little true believers. And then one of the great characters in the show as well, Dedra Miro, played by Denise Go, is like a true believer, but hers is almost pitched to like a, I feel like there's fear in her heart about like, if the Empire doesn't lock its shit down, they're all gonna die. And I mean, she's right,
but she's hers in a is position almost of like power this, versus him, whose power has almost been like taken out from under him.
Yeah. Well, and he never really had it. But you get the impression like he applied for the Empire and failed out and had to stick with Primor Security, which maybe someone in his family got him that job before they had to then call Uncle What's-His-Face to get him the job in fuel purity, I want to say.
Yeah.
His mother, extremely overbearing, a phenomenal performance from this tiny woman who just, every line she delivers is to bite into him, and he delivers a lot of lines back. They have phenomenal dialogue where he's just like trying to eat cereal like in a like a low level Coruscant apartment. I love that Coruscant, just as a little shout out, is laid out vertically, right? Like Mon Mothma's apartment has these great views. She's important. And then Cyril Karn's apartment is like a couple down low. And then, you know, when they're doing sneaky deals, like we'll talk about in today's episode, like you have to go 300 levels down and it looks like Blade Runner.
Yep. The cultural status of, like, kind of portrayed about Coruscant was really a big takeaway for me too. I thought that, that was a world that, well, of all the planets that they should be returning to frequently in Star Wars, Coruscant's the one that makes the most sense because it's where all the politics kind of go down. The entire planet is a city, which is amazing. That's like one of the coolest concepts of Star Wars to me. And it's always been underexplored, but I never wanted too much information about it. And the fact that we just kind of get this really nice extended sequence in one of the earlier episodes of Cyril Karn's character taking transit down to his old apartment or his mom's apartment. I thought that was just incredible. I thought that was like really telling about what they wanted us to know about where he, like his status in this world compared to like the people of higher class. And that enforces our sympathy for his position in the Empire. Like his worldviews are so warped, but you can kind of get, you get a really good sense of why based on the visual information. And then you get his like relationship with his mom, which is incredibly toxic and pathetic, and is probably the best word I can use to describe it, right?
Yeah, I think what Gilroy's doing with him is, I think my take is that it's easy, it would be really easy to show just like, you know, an Imperial person in power doing extremely scummy things. And to an extent they do that with Dedra Miro, but I find her compelling too as like the only one who seems to get it at her level. They're like, I was watching this with the latest time I went through the show, I watched it with my girlfriend, and she was like, I hate like what Dedra Miro does, but like every time she has a win, I feel like I'm on her side. Right, when she does something correctly and she gets one over on her co-supervisors who are being reductive or being sloppy in their work. So it's a real weird balancing act there. But I think with Cyril Karn, I think Gilroy's going even further and being like, this is like the worst of the worst, because this is like a true believer who has no power. And he becomes creepy, right? Where he becomes kind of obsessed with Dedra Miro and starts talking about how he's like, until I saw you, like I thought that there was no justice in the world or no beauty and no truth, like all this like weird poetic stuff. And I find all those scenes very compelling because both those actors have a lot of juice and they've got such great lines to work with. But he's undeniably just like, he's trying to show you like the worst of the worst that the Empire could have, which is like, someone who isn't even doing it for careerist reasons. He believes these things and can't even get them done.
It's a really different interpretation of the Empire, and I think it was really validated by the performance and by the visual information we get about this character. And like I was saying, the mother character just is so overbearingly awful. I wanted to shout out that performance to Catherine Hunter, who I've only seen in a few things ever. I know she was in Harry Potter, but recently I saw her in Poor Things, and she was incredible in that. What a talented, powerful actor, Catherine Hunter. Really, really talented. I will watch anything she's in. I heard she's in The Tragedy of Macbeth, so I will be watching that very soon.
That sounds
soon.
Right, yeah.
And right on. What did I want to say about Dedra Miro? Oh, well, you mentioned that your girlfriend was kind of interested in the wins for this character, and I thought that kind of reflected what Gilroy said about the character, who said that she was like, it was their intention to make her like this strong female character working her way through a male environment, and I thought that that was not overly, like, it wasn't overstated. But you could kind of like tell by looking around the room that she had to kind of earn her status. We get a little brief conversation about what her supervisor saw in her. And like, it was just, she was putting up impressive numbers. So they called her up and they bring her in. And then she continues to like basically beat out all these like non-believers or these people who aren't as into the cause as she is. And that is really powerful stuff. That's a really powerful arc that we now understand, like, basically all the background of why this very powerful, what's the agency, ISB?
ISB, which is like Naval Intelligence, but for the Empire.
Yeah, Imperial Security Bureau.
Like, or like essentially like SS, I guess. Like yeah. If you needed a bad guy corollary.
So yeah, she basically fulfills like this role of like she's gonna basically be the main villain from here on out. And we now have like a full backstory on her rise to power, which I think is actually something that TV can do. They can give you a lot of good background information over a long period of time, versus movies don't have that luxury. But what tends to happen is TV shows usually over explain and give you too much information, or not as concise as you need it to be. So versus this character, where it's like little tidbits where we see like she wins this battle, she moves up, she defends her position and why she like went behind her supervisor's back, wins that discussion. It's just nonstop. Yeah. She's like continuing to prove her points, and we see how cunning she will be moving forward as like the lead villain. And in the last episode, we get a great moment where she has this amazing scared look on her face when she thinks she's going to die.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really powerful moment too, because now she is extra motivated, and she has crazy Cyril Karn with her now. So talk about creating like this powerful villain duo moving forward.
Well, and that's where you wonder, like, had she seen any action before? Or has she been executing her entire role for the Empire out of boardrooms? And then, you know, that riot gets out of hand, and, like, there's a part where, like a group of guys are dragging her one way, and, like, Denisco, what was her name? Denisco really sells it. Like, just, like, after being, like, so passionate, so strong, and so assured, and, like, just... Her whole arc is just correcting people, right? Where, like, again, the guy's like, we're obviously not going to give them a funeral procession. She's like, no, of course you are. This is the kill box for Andor. Why is she the only one who gets this? It all works really well.
Yeah, and the fact that she has to kind of explain herself so many times really shows the Empire's lack of understanding the rebels, or the concern that they need to have for the rebels, which Cassian kind of also like comments on several times throughout the show. Like, they don't care about us, that's why we're gonna be able to start
the first
uprising.
The first time he meets Luthen, where he's saying, you act like you belong, you walk in and take it. He's going, they're so big, they think they don't have to care. And it's just these small, like, guerrilla warfare concepts that continue to be proven true in other ways throughout the show, like the episode we're going to talk about today, where, like, you know, a dozen guards per level aren't going to be able to hold off 100 men, right? Not if they apply a little bit of strategy and a little bit of thwart.
Huge oversights based on, like, just the accelerated rise to power for the Empire probably pushed them to have a lot of naivety about uprisings. And when I like that the purpose of the uprising actually is to cause more damage to civilians, right? In order to expedite this process to create faster rebellion, versus lulling lulling the galaxy into a state of inferiority.
Yeah, well, it's a metaphor that I'm surprised didn't come up in this, but, like, kudos to Tony Gilroy for not, and Bo Willimon and the other writers for not being so obvious. But it's that boiling the frog metaphor. You ever heard it, where, like, if you put a frog into boiling water, it'll jump out immediately. If you slowly raise the temperature, it'll die before it realizes. And it's that kind of thing where, like Luthen saying that, like, the Empire will slowly tighten its grip on the galaxy before they realize what's happening. But if we steal a quarterly payroll for an entire sector on Aldani, and they overreact with the public order resentencing directive, and, like, levying huge taxes and things like that and becoming way harder, it's going to spur way more rebellions to rise up, because things would become so unreasonable so fast.
Yeah, the one that really got me that's, like, super political and, like, almost, like, too complicated for, like, the children viewers to understand is just, like, they're going to tax planets for the prisoners that they take from those planets. And I was like, whoa, so that's really gonna piss all these planetary systems off. And it's just like, when you're, like, getting this information, you're like, oh, they're really, like, you know, as a viewer, like, they're messing up big time here. Like, yeah, this is going to cause way more rebellion than they expect. And mm-hmm. I really like that you as a viewer feel that before they even have to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
It felt nice.
And I mean, that's exemplified in our episode today, which I think we can hop to if you're ready, Tay.
Yeah, and I thought like a quick like transition into that too was also like we have Cassian kind of say these things within the prison too, where he's like, do you really think they're mm-hmm. listening to us? No one is listening to us, basically. And because they don't care. They don't have that level of respect for what we can accomplish as a unified rebellion. And
they probably couldn't devote the resources if they needed to anyway, to get like one-to-one exactly. guards to prisoners or even a slightly better ratio. There's not enough Imperial officers, right? There's not enough stormtroopers.
Yeah, because they started taking prisoners so fast. And we see like Cassian's arrest is just so ridiculous. And we understand that his is like just one of the thousands and thousands, right? Which I think is like very grounded in reality too, to be honest. I thought that that was a nice little touch.
Yeah, you get swept up in almost like a bureaucratic error, but then you get thrown in prison for, I think when they show his count, I think it's 7 years in prison. Even if he's getting out after 7 years.
Yeah, he gets 6 years, but
6 years. Okay. It was something like 2,100 days. So yeah, it's closer to six, but yeah. And that's like those things really like they get right in my lizard brain when I see a character I identify with and they get kind of like jammed up by a system and you're like, but no, he didn't actually, he's not like, they're not even taking him in for Aldani. They're taking him in because he was standing next to a guy who was running. It's so compelling. It just gets right in my blood.
Yeah. And we kind of, I don't know, maybe before we jump into our episode scene, like the whole series is broken down into basically three key components. We have four, if you include like the initial murder for Cassian, where he has to like then run. He then gets involved in the heist squad through Luthen. And then we talked about the arrest. He goes to prison and we have the prison break sequence, which is our scene or our episode for today. And then we have the funeral to kind of be the big climax. But I'd say like the much two bigger sequences than the climax are the heist and the prison break scene. So today we're doing episode 10 of Andor, season 1, which is called One Way Out. In this episode, things have been building to this point where they have now realized there is no escaping, that a prisoner who was released was mistakenly put back into the same prison. A whole floor of this prison found out that this is the way that things were running, and the prison guards had to execute this entire floor of 100 men to keep them quiet. We know from the minimal communications we've seen in the prison up to this point that there's communication between the levels and there's rumors, but it's only clarified at the end of episode 9 that it actually happened. So episode 10 starts us out with Kino, who is played by Andy Serkis wonderfully.
No makeup, no CGI, it's his face.
Right.
And to that extent, I'll touch on it briefly, but I think he actually has developed a habit of overacting a little bit. I don't think it's bad, but I think he really lays on the sauce because I think he's gotten used to having to work through layers of obfuscation. I think it's a necessary part of being a mocap or a voice actor. But he was a really welcome sight. I think he's great in this.
Whether you're right or wrong about that, his performance works at that level in this in the show.
Yeah.
And, you know, we only get a few episodes with him in it, and I was really happy when he showed up. He's obviously played another character in the Star Wars universe, so I was like, oh, it's cool that Andy Serkis is showing up as a different character now. But basically, this episode all starts with him and Cassian going back into the prison, like into the ward. What would you call that? Like the cell block, I guess?
Cell block, yeah.
Yeah. So the episode starts with Kino and Cassian going back into the cell block, having learned this information. And basically Cassian has to tell the fellow prisoners what's going on. But then it is Kino who finally convinces them this is what's actually happening. And they need to create a prison break.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of push this episode as the one we talk about because I do think it's a lot of Gilroy's thesis statement for what I think this season of the show and the idea of looking at Andor character is about. And I think like this one particularly, like he definitely you know, the heist sequence, he learns so much in the heist arc about the rebellion, especially from people like Nemec, who's writing literally a manifesto on why rebellion is important and things that, you know, that could maybe sway other people. And he keeps that with him. But you also see many different types of rebellion, all the many characters in that heist squad, some of whom are false themselves, some of whom are what he was being accused of being when they realized that he was a hired mercenary.
Yeah, like you're referring to Skeen, the character.
Yeah, Skeen. So good. Everyone on that crew, like, I wish we could have done the heist episode too, because I love it just as much, but I think this one's a little bit more core. Because I do think in the prison sequence, he's now learning to use the tools of rebellion, and the biggest obstacle there is getting other people on board. Like, it's this little microcosm for a galactic rebellion just in this prison, right? The Empire isn't paying attention. They don't have the resources to actually maintain control. They have one or two lines of defense that are very effective, but like any system, there are flaws. The system is designed to address certain things, so it always has blind spots. All of those can be addressed. The thing that he needs to do is convince the other people to work with him, because he can't do it alone. And I think that's just, it's this little, it's writ small, the whole show itself. And I think you have a fairly compelling back and forth between Kino and him, because Kino, I mean, I'll stop talking in a second, but like, I think the episode's title, One Way Out, obviously is quoted a lot in the show, but I think on a thematic level, what they're talking about is that you cannot just keep your head down and do your time like Cassian was doing at the beginning of the show before he got involved with the Primor guys, and what Kino's doing in the prison. You cannot play by their rules, because they'll keep changing the rules. So there's the only way out is rebellion. The only moral response to fascism is rebellion. And I think this is a nice little microcosm of it.
I want to mention two things before we really get into it based on that. One, you mentioned, like, he's kind of keeping his head down. He's got his money from the heist, and he tries to escape to literally what's referred to as a tourist planet called Neimos.
Yeah.
I thought that was, like, a cool, like, that was, like, one of those little insertions where it's, like, I want to, like, create this little planet without much information, and we'll just have it be, like, this. It's basically a resort
planet.
Yeah,
like, the entire place is sandals, right?
Yes.
and it also has an absolute banger of a soundtrack when it's introduced, like,
right, it does, it's really good. And the second thing I wanted to say was that the aesthetic and the security mechanism built into the prison is very cool. I really thought that was a good concept. It kind of reminded me of that kind of lame Stallone movie from like 10 years ago, Escape Plan, where they're in that prison with like the metal boots. Am I thinking of the right movie?
Well, and they also, I mean, the Face Off has the magnet boots.
Sorry, that's what I was talking about. Right? That's what I'm talking about. Facebook, or Face Off.
Facebook. This has nothing to do with Social Network.
I'm blending all of our previous episodes together, even though we're never talking about movies again.
Yeah.
The idea that these floors can fry you, basically, through because they're this specific type of metal from the Star Wars universe, which is, once again, great use of science fiction. This is how you do it. You bring in something from science fiction and you make it relatable to reality, like that we can relate to, and it becomes powerful and palpable. Beautiful stuff by Gilroy again. And they come up, they make up this metal that is chargeable, and it's a great, it seems like a flawless security system. You literally have like the opening scene of Andor showing up at the prison, and the guards are like, so you see how we don't have any guns? And it's like, okay, we get it.
How do you think we get away with that, right? Yeah.
And I thought that was all really effective. It really, it's fear-inducing, even like to someone as skeptical as me, who's like, we're not going to see anyone get fried. Don't worry. just the idea of it happening is, it's actually pretty scary. So I just wanted to shout out those two things for background. Like the Neimos planet, but the aesthetic of this prison is very intimidating until you realize that it has like its fatal flaw, which they kind of figure out right before this, which is it's undermanned, and you can deactivate the floor with a bit of water.
Yeah, and I think there are a couple things I want to touch on there. I do want to double down on what you said about the prison design, and I also just think it's refreshing, because I think the easiest thing to do would be put you in a dank scary prison, like right. prisons. We think about them in movies all the time. I meant to mention this before, and this doesn't have to be a huge tangent, but like I watched on your recommendation and with your copy, I watched Papillon last night, and like, boy, like that, there's just so many parallels and things like right. that between right. like, right. Like the second time that, and spoilers for Papillon, I'll give you 5 seconds to turn off your thing. When you have like Bix after being tortured, how much that lines up with like the second time that Steve McQueen comes out of the solitary and he's just like white as a sheet and he's just a different person. Like there's a lot to inform there. So I don't know if you're compelled by the sort of prison stuff and the oppressive nature of like a controlling party whose system you're a part of. Papillon's really, I think, aligned with some of the ideas. And not so much rebellion, but just continual escape is explored in Papillon. But anyway, I did want to mention that I think you get more Papillon-style prisons is your first thought for something like this. But this prison is clean. It appears to be warm. They always have clean uniforms.
They're well fed.
They've all got their own
sleep.
Bunks. Yep, they're clean. Like, everything's fine. And there's not like the things that, like, I think it's so easy to put in a prison where it's like, what if another prisoner wants to shiv you or take advantage of you or, you know, none of those issues are the actual issue. The
good PG-13 writing, just saying.
Right? The oppressive thing is the environment itself. They're saying, like, you're in the Empire's control. Every foot you step on the floor is somewhere where you're under threat of death. And then in the end, they use the planet's most abundant natural resource, the water. They bring that in to destroy it. Like, again, that's just a little thematic touch that I'm sure probably someone in a writer's room was like, I like this, but it also, it's electricity. Of course, they're going to beat it with water. It's just how it goes.
Yeah. And like you're saying, we kind of, there needs to be this moment of convincing the collective to join or else it will fail. Mm-hmm. And we have a moment in either an episode before this or two episodes before this where we see Cassian trying to cut the water main in the bathroom, kind of doing it on his own, like kind of his own operation. And then we see him actually like be able to fulfill that plan, but having everybody on board in this scene when they bring in a new prisoner to replace the recently deceased guy, Ulav, which was a really wonderful bit of story writing there too. I thought that all flowed really nicely. I was wondering what the reasoning for this older character on the block was, and then like they really made use of that. They used every shred of some of these characters that they possibly could have to inform the narrative, which was really strong writing in my opinion too. The prison break
itself is
great.
It's also how they introduce Melshi.
Right.
Yeah. Who comes in? He's a part of Rogue One till the very end. He makes it to the beaches on Scarif.
That's right. Yep, and I like how we have that, just on that, to end that note, I like how we have that little beat with them at the end of this episode. Or, no, it's actually, I think, in the following episode, isn't it?
It's the following one where they go back to Neimos because he has to get all his money and his blaster, and they go their separate ways to sort of start spreading the word, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or that's what Melshi says, at least. Cassian wants to go see his mom.
That's right. So let's get to this prison break. Because I think it's fairly conventional how it all goes down, but I really like just all the information they've given us up to this point, including the aesthetics and the prison layout. I thought all conveyed like this really compelling prison break scene, but there's nothing like super exciting about like the actual drama of it. It all goes pretty smoothly once they start the prison break.
I think they never really put you at a moment where you're like, I don't know, are they going to make it out? And I think that would probably be disingenuous about all the things where they're like, this is the nature of the Empire. They do not have the resources. So if we pull this off, if we pull off the moment where they blow the floor and it doesn't work anymore, and then Andy Serkis says attack again and everyone in the room attacks, it's over. That's the win.
Exactly.
And I like that they're never like, I don't know, are they going to get him? Because like, as soon as you go to that central control module where the guys like fry the whole level and then they walk in and get him to stop and you're like, yeah, like we're not really worried about this. And I think you're right. There's never like, I think the emotion of the scene is largely just triumph. You can see these things happen. And then, you know, the more of the thing that's left up to up to see what happens is, will Kino be able to give a, like, be able to get the entire prison to go? And then Andy Serkis gives like that kind of like very like high blood pressure, but like almost like watery eyed speech. Like, it's very compelling stuff where he's explaining how, what the Empire did, you know, they, because of the PORD, they've made prison terms unending. And then they immediately made a mistake, because of course you would, where like they have to send a guy back to prison and hope that he doesn't tell anyone that he was in this prison just like the last day. And they make an obvious error, and then they fry a whole floor to cover their tracks. And then, you know, Kino has to get everyone, the whole prison, to rise up. And I think that's the part where you're like, is he going to pull this off?
Yeah, and it's really powerful that he echoes what Cassian says earlier, right? He says, I'd rather die than, or trying to take them down than die giving them what they want. I guess, can we briefly touch on actually what they're designing? Like, or like the whole idea of the floors?
So that was the spoiler I was going to say. This is the only, I think, true celebrity cameo in the show. Did you see the post credit scene where they show
at
you
the end,
what
yeah.
these components go to?
Yeah.
Yeah, they show you that they're parts of like the satellite disc part of the weapon on the Death Star.
Yes. So basically all these, I don't even know what you call them, like almost panels, or like they're like the holders for the
panels. They're like
the
these like six ends like things. Yeah. They're almost like the back structure for a panel cell. Right.
Yeah. And just, you see how many they make per day and how fast they move. And then you see like there must be millions and millions of these components going into this massive Death Star satellite. And yeah. I really liked that the prison system was laid out like this too. Like, we already touched on like the aesthetic and the cleanliness and like, but all that is to encourage the workflow, which I thought like
yeah.
in the pipeline of this product, which is really effective because it shows the manipulation. And it also shows like when you get that reveal at the end of the season, it's like, oh, that's like the thing Andor is going to end up destroying, like being a part of destroying.
Yeah.
But he's also contributing to the making of it, like, because he ended up in this system. And that's like, that's devastating. Like the idea that I figured we would get some insight as to what they're making, but even the idea that they're making something for the Empire and they create this like false competitive environment in there to kind of create this.
Yeah. I love
motivation.
Like the whole thing where Kino's like, that you play against your table plays against the other tables. I play our room against the other rooms on the level.
Yeah.
And like, if you win, you get real food. If you lose, you get tortured. And it's that simple. And then, yeah, on top of that, it's like, as a prisoner, it's not just, I have had my freedom taken away from the Empire. I am actively contributing to the development of their weapon of mass destruction that will only make things worse. Right. It's just that extra insidious level of like the brazenness of an occupying power, right. Of something that believes it's all powerful. And you're right. It's kind of sickening when they reveal that.
Yeah. I like that they waited like two episodes after this prison break to have that at the end too, because like you kind of almost forget. But just going back to the end of the prison break, I think you get like a really streamlined prison break scene where there's not many obstacles. A lot of the guys that we come to recognize their faces die on the floor, like from shots from the guards. But for the most part, a lot of the guys make it out. It's when they actually get to the water and Andy Serkis has that moment.
This is crushing.
It's
crushing. This is like... I said it's like he gets a Rocky finish, I think is the optimistic way to look at it, where it's like Rocky doesn't beat Apollo Creed, but like, you know, he did it. He did the thing. But like, I feel like I haven't seen The Great Escape in a couple years. Is there not someone who like makes it out of the tunnel but doesn't make it out, you know?
Yeah.
It makes me think of the guy who can't see without his glasses, who they don't let him be a part of the escape. It's somewhere in that thing where you're just like, I remember, like, you know, my sister telling me when she got to this part, and it just, like, it ruined her day, like, because you're so on Kino's side at that point. And he's smiling, too, because he got out, like, he did. He just didn't get all the way out, and it has nothing to do with, like, giving into the Empire, but it is such a mixed hit, victory. It really hits you right in the gut.
And I know, like, this is going past our episode, but the fact that then we learn that almost none of the swimmers made it to shore.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, yeah. It's quite possible that only Melshi and Cassian survived the whole, out of like the mm-hmm. however many hundreds of the men were like swimming in the water to get to shore.
Yeah.
Which is something I thought about being a realist, but I never thought they'd actually come down on that point in the show. I would never have guessed.
Mm-hmm.
We never get any close-ups of people in water, which I thought might have been editing, that they might have had that stuff filmed and chosen to take it out. It would have been, honestly, I couldn't imagine trying to like write this without having a shot of them hitting the water, but also it might have been clearly intentional to avoid all that and only use implication to suggest a lot of these guys were swimming. And because we get that really great shot from way up above the prison,
yeah, where they're like little just like swimmers moving away from this massive unnatural structure right in the middle, this panopticon style prison.
But you don't really know how cool bad stuff. The scenario is until Cassian and Melshi get to shore.
And then you realize like you're like, oh yeah, like there, this isn't Earth where like if you get to another country you might be okay. You have to get off a planet, right? Like it's insane the scale at which like Star Wars so often operates, where it's like your car is a spaceship, so like you can't just drive 4 days west and hide from the Empire. You have to go six planets away, so three star systems away, right in the galaxy.
Yeah, that's actually a really good note that they add in the following episode when they do get off planet by literally trying to commandeer what's been suggested is a very old rickety ship that like, literally can just take off from a shoreline and go into space. So, it's creating a very realistic scenario in a world that we don't fully grasp. So like it's giving us that extra context, I think, which is really nice.
And then, sorry,
go ahead. We're going to touch on the end of the episode.
I was just going to say, let's move to the rest of the episode, but we haven't, like, I think we should devote at least a couple minutes to, we haven't talked much about Diego Luna, who, you know, has to, like, hold this show together. I think his development, reverse chronology, but still, like, as an actor and into this character, and also, like, I'm assuming just like he had a bit of a glow up because he got this job on this TV show, but his face is fuller and he's a bigger guy. But that also makes way more sense that like in Rogue One, he would be way skinnier. He's eating less. He's more on the run. But I think he's a really compelling presence. I think he looks great with the beard. And I think he has all these different relationships with different people, like the number of different people he has to come into contact with over the course of this series. I think he's a really strong focal point, especially given that like the cast itself is so talented and has so many characters to offer you. I feel like he could be more of a cipher and just be like, yeah, the show is Andor, but Andor allows you to meet Deirdre Miro and Cyril Karn and Val and Mon Mothma and Luthen, yada yada yada.
And Luna also, like I mentioned earlier, he produced the show. I think he had a lot of belief in this character and was really excited when Gilroy wanted to expand on it. I think that, well, based on his statement, that he said that he was very excited that Gilroy allowed this character to be played as a refugee, as a Mexican citizen. He had some issues dealing with Mexican-American relationships in his personal life, and he felt that a lot of those struggles were very well reflected in his struggle with this character.
I think he's very compelling. I think it's really cool that he gets to be this guy, because like I think if you look as a similar thing in so many other movies where it's like, this is an offshoot movie, we have a secondary character, they'd never make a TV show out of it, and they'd never make it off of a guy like Diego Luna who hasn't been in a ton of stuff. So it's a really special lightning in a bottle type thing.
It is.
Love that the show clearly did well enough that it'll get another season. I think they said it's two and done. They may have said three and done, but they're
said
not
three
like
at first,
we'll go
but now
as long
it's
as
two,
we can.
I think.
Yeah, which, again, that works for me. I will briefly call out just very quickly, there's a really charming interview with Diego Luna on one of the late night shows where he explains what he used to think R2-D2 was called, because in Spanish, it's Arturito.
Yeah.
Which is just sort of like the syllables track the same thing, but Arturito in Spanish means little Arthur. So he just thought like R2-D2's name was Arthur, right? But he's little, you know, he's shorter, right? And I really like that. So I'll post that in the notes if anyone hasn't seen that. It's a really charming little story.
Yeah, he's a pretty charming fella, Diego Luna, from the interviews I've seen him in. He's got such a great filmography, to like his early work with some of the greatest filmmakers, you know, Alfonso Cuarón.
Mm-hmm. He's good. And probably, was he in an Iñárritu as well, or no? Is just Cuarón?
Don't quote me on it.
All right. Well, again, we're running out of time. I do want to briefly just touch on Mon Mothma gets a scene in this, and it's a really kind of like sinister scene. I think it builds super effectively. I think if we were doing episode by episode, this would be something I'd want to talk about in more detail, but we don't have a ton of the time. That basically her arc over the series is like she's trying to use more of her family fortune from Chandrila to help support the rebel cause through Luthen, and the Empire's put more and more controls over financial action, right, by wealthy citizens under their control. So through many machinations, things like that, she has proposed that she can be helped out by this a mobster from Chandrila called Davos Gul'dan, who in this episode comes to visit her and explain what he wants in return. And I just think it's such a light touch where they arrive at the idea that Davo wants to hook up his son with Mon Mothma's daughter. And they've already established in early episodes that Mon Mothma does not care for this Chandrilan heritage tradition where children are betrothed to one another at like age 14. It's how she ended up in this horrible marriage.
I really
she
like
wants
that
nothing
note,
like
by
that
the
for
way.
Her daughter.
The like her yeah. questioning of tradition and that the fact that it's not like something they have to do, but she's making has to make the conscious choice to do something that she's against.
Yeah. And also like I really like the texture that her daughter is like, no, her daughter wholeheartedly likes the Chandrilan traditions. Right, that culture offers her something that Mon Mothma doesn't care for at all. Maybe because Mon Mothma has the benefit of hindsight in having married, a gambling addict kind of asshole husband. And then she has to uphold her culture if she's going to keep on with the rebellion, and not even just like keep funding the rebellion. It sounds like the Empire is going to find out what she did any day. So she's put in a really tough. There's a lot of people in this episode who are trapped. In the final part of the episode, which we're about to talk about, Lonnie is told that he's trapped. Mon Mothma is trapped. Prisoners are, and there's one way out in every instance, right? And they're generally not very easy ways. And more and more, Gilroy is suggesting you will sacrifice part of your humanity, or at least act against your own beliefs in order to further the cause of rebellion. It's really complex stuff.
Which I think is why this episode is like the best example of a microcosm of the whole series, because we do get this kind of fulfilling speech at the end from Luthen as he speaks what's the guy's name he's speaking to?
He's speaking to Lonnie.
Lonnie.
With the red mustache.
Yeah, great mustache on Lonnie. That scene, I felt it was a little surprising, that scene, to me, honestly. It just felt like it kind of was surprising, the moment, but I liked the aesthetic of it. I liked the actual dialogue of it. It didn't feel out of place, but I was just a little surprised by that scene that it happened when it did. But it really does stress the fact that Luthen knows that he's not going to be alive to see the end of it, which is, I thought, the best note from that whole speech, is that when Lonnie questions him about what he's sacrificing, he has a pretty solid answer, which is like, I'm not even going to see the end of this, whereas you might.
Yeah, he's got stuff that's been weighing on him. And I 100% I can agree that like it's a little out of the tone of the show in general for someone to be like this verbose. I think it's slightly earned in that Luthen is so often not showing you his heart. And
exactly.
In fact, this is an instance where bearing his soul furthers his end, which is making sure Lonnie stays in line and keeps being a spy in the Empire. And then like it comes down to, I think, personal preference. I think Skarsgård just like knocks it out of the park with like really juicy lines. Like no actor wouldn't want these lines where he says like, I've made my mind a sunless place. I share my dreams with ghosts, right? Like it's Shakespearean,
it's juicy,
essentially. And then like, in terms of how it's all presented, like I love this because like, you know, it one of the last lines in the speech is like, I need all the heroes I can get. And they, I think, in specific Star Wars iconography, they position Luthen as a villain in this shot where he's got this black cloak on and he's on a catwalk. And all the worst things in Star Wars happen on catwalks.
That's
and I don't
point.
Know how intentional that was or not, but like that's where you find out that someone's your dad and you thought he was the bad guy. That's where, you know, characters we love die being killed by family members. Like catwalks are really sinister in Star Wars. And I had never seen anyone point that out, that like he's going to make it clear like being a rebel is not fun, especially for the people who are getting the rebellion kickstarted. I'm bound to use the weapons of my enemy against them at the cost of my soul. Like, I think it sums it up in very text level. It's on the surface, but I think it really hit me like a ton of bricks the first time I saw this. And like, it's Skarsgård, who we haven't talked about at all, but this guy rules, right?
Yeah,
he's such
really
a
incredible.
Menacing presence. Yeah.
I love that he was, like, I saw an interview with him about it, and I just love how excited he was about being in Star Wars. But I think doing it on his terms, like being in a much more grounded, mature Star Wars IP, was really important to him. And I just want, like, my final note really about his speech is kind of reflective of how I felt was, I felt was really reflective of one of the greatest strengths of the TV show in as a whole, which was being a rebel is not only hard, but you have to make very tough decisions and you won't get answers that you want to hear. So when Lonnie asks for an out, he has a lot of good reasons for needing out, including his own health and the health of his like baby child. But it's not good enough. That's still not enough to warrant an out. As Luthen says, we've invested too much in you and the rebellion has its cost. And the fact that we have this moment where a character who we cheer for through most of the show, but we understand has very like he's clearly like there's something underlying about this character we don't know yet, I'm sure. We get really good instances of him being very proficient with violence that is sort of unfounded at this point. And I think that that's going to be maybe something in season two we learn a bit more about, but there's something more sinister about this character, or at least at the very least, he's very cunning to the point where he has to make very hard decisions for other heroes in the rebellion.
And I agree with all that, and I'll wrap up as well because I don't want to be too long-winded on it. But I think another great aspect that ties into this is he visits Saw Gerrera either in the episode before or the episode after, and in terms of how it influences Rogue One, I think like Luthen's really planting the seed that turns Saw into a paranoid freak by the end of his life, where he's like Tubes is working for me. I don't know what to tell you. I got spies everywhere. Right? And like, you see like Saw's like, I completely underestimated the game I was playing and I need to turn up the knob a bit. And then you see where that ends him in the movie we talked about last time.
That's a good point.
And then otherwise just, I think the scene, it's easy to overlook it, but I think it opens with something that's totally informed by how it ends, which is he, I think, truly tries to congratulate Lonnie on the birth of his child. And Lonnie's like, what game are you playing? And he's like, this is the point. I can't even congratulate someone on the birth of their child without them thinking I'm threatening them. He's like, I'm not a human anymore because I want to be this good at what I do. And because I think it's this important. And I think it's just super powerful. Obviously, it's why we talked about this episode.
It just makes all of his other decisions make more sense, and you feel the hardship of his other decisions based on this moment. So, like, after this moment happens, I'm able to look back through all of the things I've seen him do so far and be like, every single one of these decisions was this hard, too. And that's really important for a long-running... Like, this is why TV sometimes doesn't work, because you need to have these strong connections throughout. And if you miss on like any of these character arcs, then you kind of screw up everything. And TV shows tend to have a lot more characters, a lot more storylines, and a lot more opportunity to mess things up. And this really, I think it's really strong writing on all these levels because it's building, and it's building these characters to a point.
It's really impressive. I think on a whole, this is a great case for, I think, a full idea was in place before they moved on this show at all. I think Gilroy had an idea for all the characters. I'm sure they were fleshed out. I'm sure there were rewrites on the day on the scripts for dialogue and things like that. but they were not saying, let's see where we go. Let's just, if we don't know what to do, we'll put Darth Vader in an episode. Like, this was a story first. It was character first, and that's why it's paid off so well. And I'm really looking forward to season two, because I think it'll be about, my guess is, like, it's got to take Andor from where he was at the end of season one, which is, like, ready to be a rebel. He understands the cause. He understands how to be a rebel, too. He's seen the tools and the spirit, like, the motivation. You have to get him from there to who he is at the beginning of Rogue One, which is a guy who will shoot another rebel without a moment's hesitation for the good of the mission. I think it's going to be a pretty dark season.
From what I read, it's going to literally lead to the exact start of Rogue One, where we see his character for the first time. So that guy he kills at the beginning of Rogue One, I'm guessing, will be introduced sometime in the season. And it's literally going to, like, that's not my favorite way of handling it, to be honest, but if that's what their decision was from day one when they started writing the script, then I'm okay with that. That's, like, probably whatever you set up at the beginning, whatever your pitch was, it's going well so far, so stick to it. The problem with all these Disney properties is they often have too much control from above over these products, from, like, the Kathleen Kennedys. It seems like she really gave up on trying to make this part of, like, the other Star Wars movies. This is something very different for Disney, and I think that they've embraced that, which is, to their credit, that's impressive.
That's a good call. And yeah, so you mentioned some other characters. It's got a great cast. I know there's a couple you want to shout out. You want to get to those now?
Yes. So Alex Ferns is in my favorite TV show of all time, which is Chernobyl, which I would hesitate to call a TV show. Yeah. It is a miniseries / long movie. And he played my favorite character in that show by a long shot.
The miner.
I think he's one of the best written characters I've ever seen. And did you know, Tim, he's only in one episode of Chernobyl?
It's just the one where they have to dig out to cool it down for three
of the five episodes in my mind. But no, he's actually
he's
only
such
in
a
one.
Presence.
It's just presence. And so Alex Ferns played Sergeant Linus Mosk, who is paired up with Cyril Karn for a lot of it. Tim pointed out that he has, like, the more rousing speech, and it's true. Yeah. Everything this guy says sounds amazing, so I would listen to him too. And he's got good presence. He's like he's a big man. Looks like he'd be powerful if he ever got into a physical altercation. And I think that we'll see more of him in season two being brought into a bigger role by Cyril Karn, because he helped Karn get to Cassian at the end of the season. So we'll see him again, hopefully. I really liked his performance and just his presence overall. The other actor, really quick, is Ebon Moss Bachrach. I hope I'm saying that right. I seen him in the show The Bear, which he's really good in too. He's another electric blue-eyed, watery-eyed guy.
Yeah. No one looks quite like Ebon Moss Bachrach. You see him, it's him, you know?
Yep. One of my favorite scenes from the whole season was the scene where him and Cassian have that talk with, when he's got his shirt off and Cassian's noticing his tattoos.
Yeah.
That was a really fantastic scene. Really good control of his, like, he's got such excellent control of his dialogue is what I think is my favorite part about this actor in both the things I've seen him in. I really want to see him in other
Never
stuff.
Never in a rush.
But he's got excellent control and very delicate, like almost like he's anything could set him off at any time. And that adds a lot to this character, the idea of the rebellion in general, and his performance just elevates all this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, that scene, as he wrap it up, the axe forgets, but the tree remembers.
Yes.
Like, I can hear him saying it, right? Like, yeah, he's just, the way he talks is great, and he's got his own pace, and he's never rushing through. I mean, he's not really cast as a guy with manic energy, so he wouldn't talk fast, but he's just, yeah, he's got a real great presence about him. And I was really happy because, yeah, I'd watched The Bear, and I'd seen him in Girls. And when he popped up in episode 4, the start of the heist one, I was like, this guy is like a really good, like, slimier Han Solo. Like, he's kind of in that same space, but like when he's got his shirt off, he's not in great shape, and he's a little just like scummier, and he was a great point of texture in that team.
Yep. Really important to have like the dark side of that of the rebellion, and he arguably is the most conflicting character.
Yeah. So absolutely. And then with mine, I just wanted to point out two things. One, so as I mentioned before, Nicholas Britell is the composer. So he made that great, like, Neomos dance track. But he also, I think one of the very cool aspects of this show that is easy to overlook is it has, like, a 15-second title sequence, which, first of all, thank you very much for not being, like, a three-minute. Because you really have to be good to earn that 3 minute. You got to be T-Bone Burnett in True Detective Season 1 if you want me to watch it every time. But the cool thing about this Andor title sequence is just a graphic of, again, like, it's kind of the imagery of the Death Star coming over a planet. It's one circle behind another, but the shadow forms the rebellion symbol. But as the season goes on, Britell adds more instruments and more harmony to the single motif that is Andor's motif.
Interesting.
So it's the rebellion building. It's very direct. It's a fairly obvious compositional thing to do, but it's nevertheless very effective. It's a pretty cool idea.
That's really excellent.
Especially like the episode where like the great like funeral dirge instruments that they make for the Rick's Road funeral.
I wanted to point that
those
out.
Those things are like, yeah, those things are in the title sequence for that episode. Things like that. Very smart. Little small things. And then my little like micro shout out, because we're both doing two. I love getting as small as possible. There's a moment in the second or third episode where Luthen is going from Ferrix back to Coruscant, and he changes his wig and he changes his clothes. And then there's a moment where like it's Stellan Skarsgård trying to get into character for his Coruscant guy, his antiques seller. And he kind of like puts his hand up and poses and like laughs with like some mirth. And it's just like, that's something that you don't have to show, but like, so the director of that episode, Stellan Skarsgård, someone on set was like, we should show him, like, he's an actor. That's part of what he is as a rebel. And we should show his process. That'll add a little data point. And I love it so much. It's a great moment.
Yeah. I thought that it was really embellished by him in one moment. I can't remember exactly what the scene was, but he kind of suggests like, oh, it's when he learns about, Dedra Mira. He's like, I'm glad she's wasting her time, because he's so confident that he is like actually flying under the radar. Like it'd be very hard to catch him based on the description that he knows they have of him, which is like him looking totally different.
Oh, okay. See, I think that's him playing Lonnie. That's him going like, in case Lonnie ever decides to turn on them, Lonnie thinks that like he's not even worried about it. Just like how like when people are like, you did Aldani, he's like, no, we were invited but we didn't bother. He never tells anyone the truth unless he has to, and he never has to. So I think that's what he's saying when Lonnie's like, Dedra Mira's looking for, he's like, great, she's wasting her time, I'm not, that's not even me, right?
Exactly. Like I felt like he had some confidence in that statement, but you're right, maybe he is playing Lonnie a bit there. But to me, like, how smooth his operation seems to be running and how that's conveyed throughout the season lets me believe that like he's it's pretty flawless from what I can see.
Yeah, absolutely.
Something's gonna happen with that tractor beam incident though.
I would think so. And I mean, I love that Stellan Skarsgård, we'll link it. It was from his Variety thing where he talks about his roles over the years. And yeah, he spoke about Andor being like, it's Star Wars for adults or for grown-ups, but then he also was like, but I got to do what I wanted to do when I was a boy, which have a blaster and drive a spaceship, right? And he's got these great little moments where like he pulls one over on a big Star Cruiser and things like that. Some cool moments, but I'm sure that'll come back to haunt him. And I mean, I don't see him surviving the second season.
He won't.
There's no good end for this character, except that we know that like the Empire gets overthrown. Like that's his good end. But yeah, as he said, he's not going to see it.
Yeah, it's almost for sure he won't make it through. Called that about a handful of characters throughout. But I will say the death toll did surprise me, especially in terms of our like central characters. That's all to the benefit of the story. It's honestly so rewarding to see the cost of the rebellion, as we've said many times.
Yeah. We never even got a chance to talk about Fiona Shaw and Marva. Her small acts of rebellion where she's like counting soldiers, and she uses her like final message on Earth to try to incite a riot. Like, I mean, yeah, there's just so much in the show. Too much for an episode, clearly.
Yep. Even an April Fool's Day episode.
Right? An April Fool's Day episode. Yeah, if it wasn't clear, This is a one-off thing. We'll be back for movies. Before we do, we are going to recommend some TV shows, and then we'll get back to our regularly scheduled theater schedule, because broadcasting suggests that it's TV, and we're not right. sticking with TV. I want to take this opportunity, because we're talking about TV, to recommend a TV show that not many people have seen. It's called Utopia. It's a British show from Channel 4. It aired in 2013. It maybe got 3 seasons, but maybe it had been 2. It's just a very odd show about the end of the world. All its choices, the soundtrack, the way it's shot, the way the actors act, the way it's directed, there's almost nothing like it. I'm not sure it's even easy to watch right now, but if I'm doing my one shot on a TV show, I'm going to tell people to check out Utopia. I'll link to like the IMDb or somewhere you can learn more about it, because like they made an American version a couple years after with Rainn Wilson that was quite bad. The American version was originally supposed to be done by David Fincher. That's a whole sad sliding doors moment in my mind. But anyway, that's my recommendation.
Well, hearing the fact that Fincher didn't get it and wanted it probably means it wasn't very good. Just saying.
Yeah.
My recommendation is a Star Wars TV show to kind of just go right off of this. I watched this a couple years ago when it first came out, I think. It was called Star Wars Visions. And basically, I thought that this was a great idea. Not every episode is even good, to be honest. Some of them actually suck. But for the most part, I think there's maybe 10 episodes and about half of them are really strong. They're short, so don't be deterred. Check them out if you can. Star Wars Visions is a collection of animated short films, all directed by different anime creators. And so there's very different takes on anime, obviously, and style and aesthetic. So each of these has a very different presence and different aesthetic. I thought that was really refreshing. And to me, this is what Disney should have been doing from day one with the Star Wars property. This is how you diversify your investment. This is how you create like really unique entries in the Star Wars universe without taking away from your main narrative structures in place. And I thought this was like a great shining example of what you can do when you own a property like Star Wars with such infamous iconography that it's recognizable across any aesthetic, including anime.
Yeah.
So really brilliant idea. The execution is 50-50, but if you're hesitant to start, just watch episode one. Episode one's the best one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I remember watching it and it's a mixed bag, but like, it's a really refreshing mixed bag, and you're 100% right. That's the takeaway, is like, just do this more. Do this and be like, yeah, give it to an animation studio and be like, give me 8 different styles of anime. Story does not matter quite as much, but like, ideally you could nail that down. Give Tony Gilroy, give creators like, you know, work to do like this, space to breathe, let them talk about something interesting. And by all means, keep doing the Skywalker saga in the main movies forever if you have to. I hope you don't do that either. But, you know, I was a big, to wrap the whole thing up, I was a big fan of like the first season of Mandalorian, and then that show got really locked into everything we already knew about. And then it became Boba Fett, and then they put out Obi-Wan, which was like, I watched, it doesn't matter. These are the things that I don't think did what Andor has managed to do.
Yeah, all those examples. Like, I started The Mandalorian. I was actually pretty impressed with season one. And then it went so downhill, and I realized I'd have to watch all this other garbage in order to understand what was even happening. Mm-hmm. And that's the complex nature of streaming platforms and the fact that Disney owns everything now. But my God, is that a pile of garbage, and I'm so happy that Andor was so refreshingly good. Thanks again, Tim, for the recommendation and the push to do this. I'm excited for season 2.
I think this would be fun.
Yeah. I think I'll probably try and buy this too.
I think I looked at one point, because it is like, I don't want Disney Plus to have control over whether I can watch
this again.
I've watched it through, I've watched it through 3 times. So I definitely like, and I think it works. It doesn't feel like you're left hanging. Of course, we want to know more about Andor, but with those little mini arcs, they're so conclusive in so many ways that there's a lot of really compelling, feels like complete storytelling and commentary on Star Wars. So I definitely got to pick up a Blu-ray copy of this series, just in case Disney decides to can it, like so many streaming platforms are just disappearing things. But with that's all we have to say about TV. We are back in April. with we're going to be talking about Greta Gerwig. So we'll dig into some movies. That's not a you know, there's no segue there really from Star Wars all that much. Yeah, we're going to look at some Greta Gerwig movies. So today's April Fool's, if you're listening to it on the day, I'll do the vote tomorrow because obviously this episode was dropping today. So keep an eye out. Faithful listeners who are here with us about an hour and a half into our TV episode, our one and only one.
Yeah, thanks everybody for listening. Hope you enjoyed our April Fool's Day gag / episode.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't intend for it to be this all over the place, but here we are.
Yeah. Well, this is why this format doesn't work for TV. There's too much. I want to go back to movie format. Yeah, there's one way out, and it's to the movie theater.
Well done.
Doesn't make any sense. We'll see you next time.